Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Free trade, fair trade, and a slow global economy. Congress tries to make up its mind. It's been a bad week for blackberries, you know, and one Republican on the state of the GOP. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's the 12th of October. This one's a Wednesday. Great to have you with us. So listen, Barack Obama's been in office now for, what, like 2.5 years, right? Bear that and an economy desperate for jobs in mind as I tell you this. Congress finally took up 3 free trade deals today, agreements with Colombia, Panama, and South Korea that were negotiated back in the Bush administration. So even with the prospects that the agreements would mean billions of dollars in new exports and with tens of thousands of new jobs potentially in the offing, getting to yes in Washington has proven difficult. We'll be sending off more wheat and soybeans under these deals, boats and airplanes, and beef. Marketplace's David Gura made some calls out to the ranch this morning.
Ed Griman is a cattle producer in Garner, Iowa, and these days he's thinking globally.
We are no longer in a United States market. We're in a world market.
Griman's been to South Korea on a trade mission. Cattlemen have wanted these deals for a long time. Kevin Kester owns a ranch in Parkfield in California's Central Coast region.
It's not a fairy tale situation. We've been working very hard for years to get these free trade agreements passed by Congress and implemented.
Kester says access to new markets could boost demand and raise the price of U.S. beef.
And if we have higher prices for our products, then possibly we might consider hiring more employees.
Politicians have used jobs to sell these trade agreements from the get-go, and that drives economist Donald Boudreau crazy. He teaches at George Mason University.
Freer trade doesn't create jobs or reduce jobs.
Freer trade rearranges jobs, Boudreau says. The U.S. beef industry could grow if South Koreans like our beef better than theirs. But if American car makers can't compete with South Korean auto imports, then the U.S. may lose some jobs in that sector. Boudreau says free trade is guaranteed to do one thing.
It makes us richer in the long run, is what it does.
Competition intensifies. We get more money for what we make better and more efficiently than others do. We get more value for what we buy. And that, Boudreau says, should be the selling point, not new jobs. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
We're well into day 3 of a huge outage for the BlackBerry smartphone network. Started over in Europe, then the Middle East, Africa, and India. Now it's spread over here. Service interruptions and long delays in web browsing and messaging and emailing, all that stuff you want a smartphone for. It's trouble for businesses and governments in particular, organizations that tend to sign all their employees up for BlackBerries. People who work in Congress, actually, have started calling this Blackopalypse, not the kind of buzz that's likely to keep BlackBerry users for very long now, is it? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Research in Motion, the Canadian parent company of BlackBerry, was already in trouble before this outage. It's been losing market share to the iPhone and Android, and its stock price is way down. The last time BlackBerry's network crashed like this, freezing out business and government users, was in 2009. Brian Cooley of CNET says things have changed since then.
So many of these companies have become used to, in the last couple of years, letting employees carry what they want, an iPhone or an Android device, and still connect to the company email and calendar. They've had to, because people want different devices now.
Cooley says this latest outage could hurt BlackBerry's ability to hold on to the customers it still has.
This is going to, I think, tip some unknown percent of people who are iPhone intenders but weren't quite ready to pull the trigger to make the jump from the BlackBerry.
But jumping isn't so easy if you're an individual subscriber, because you probably signed up for a 1 or 2 year contract that got you a cheap BlackBerry but will hit you with a big penalty if you bail. Carl Howe is a technology analyst at the Yankee Group. He says a growing number of customers are saying no to long-term contracts and opting to prepay month to month for their service instead.
In those contracts, you pay more for your phone but less for your service. I think consumers are getting smarter about making that trade-off.
Research in Motion, meanwhile, now has to brace for another competitive headache. Apple comes out with its new iPhone 4S on Friday. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The XPRIZE Foundation is in the news once again today. Another $1 million prize has been awarded to a company that creates a much, much better way to clean up oil spills. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has more now on innovation and the prize economy.
The X-Challenge winners, a team from Elastec American Marine, aren't newcomers to the oil cleanup business. They helped sop up after the BP oil spill. So you might wonder why they decided it was worth their time to take on the X-Challenge when what they had was already selling.
Well, of course, $1 million helped.
Okay, hard to disagree with that. Jeff Cantrell is a company VP. The publicity, that was good incentive too, so they jumped in.
The challenge, I'm going to say, sped this technology up by at least 5 years.
Which is exactly the outcome XPRIZE Foundation CEO Peter Diamandis wants, to use competition to push innovation in big ways.
As humans, we're genetically bred to compete. We do our best work when we have a clear target and we're competing against others to get there first.
That competition model isn't new. Back in 1714, the British government offered a prize to tackle a navigation mystery, longitude. Today, it's space travel, sopping up oil, and a $10,000 challenge to develop a better paper towel.
This gives you more diversity and variety of problem-solving perspectives.
Alf Bingham is the founder of Innocentive, a company that runs XPRIZE-like challenges for business and government groups. He says Innocentive has grown from posting a few challenges a month to 4 or 5 a week as leaders realize the benefits of tapping into everyone's expertise for answers to their trickiest problems. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Wall Street was fine today. Could have been better, but it was fine. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I know. It's 3 years since the financial crisis, you're saying, and still we keep coming back to the banks. Believe me when I tell you we'd rather not, but the simple truth is that the banks matter. They need to be fixed, that's true, which is why we've got the Volcker Rule being talked about and Dodd-Frank, the reform bill, and, for that matter, to some degree, Occupy Wall Street. But we're only going to be able to fix so much, so we need to know how they're doing. Tomorrow, J.P. Morgan Chase kicks off a week of bank earnings, and with it, the latest indicators of how healthy the biggest banks are. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore has the story.
Think back on the past 3 months. The U.S. flirted with default. Any bank that held Greek bonds was regarded with suspicion. Bank of America's share price barely exceeded its ATM fees. So how'd our banks pull through?
The biggest question today isn't, are the banks safe? In fact, despite concerns over Europe, we think the banks are in good financial position. And the real question is, can they earn any money? This quarter is going to be a real test of that.
That's Fred Cannon, the director of research for Keefe, Bruyette & Woods. He said banks are still contending with troubles in Europe, bad mortgages, a slow economy, volatile markets, and low interest rates that are hurting business.
We're going to see those biggest banks struggle a lot. Expectations have come down a lot for them.
One of the biggest challenges the banks face is you, me, us. In banking, checking accounts, savings accounts, and mortgages for regular people are called the retail business. Ken Landis is a consultant to the financial industry at Deloitte.
Retail banking is still the lifeblood of U.S. banking because it is the primary source of deposits that banks use to fund their lending activities.
All those new fees banks are making us pay are a sign of weakness.
So I would expect their performance will be slightly off.
The big things to watch are what banks say about their exposure to Europe's problem and bad mortgages here at home. As Halloween approaches, consumers will be watching whether banks are hiding any more skeletons in their closets. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
Occupy Wall Street moves to academia tomorrow. There are rallies planned for at least 90 college campuses, including one at Stanford University. Stanford senior Taryn Norris isn't going to be among the marchers, but he's got an opinion on Wall Street and higher education nonetheless that he set out in the Stanford Daily yesterday. That's the student newspaper there. It ran under the headline, Stop the Wall Street Recruitment, which would be recruitment on college campuses, obviously. Taryn, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So I'll tell you, when I read this today, my immediate thought was the ban on recruiting by ROTC that some schools have had, the ban on the CIA. Is that what you want? No financial institution recruitment at Stanford and other schools?
No, we're not calling for a complete ban on financial institutions. And we recognize that the United States needs a strong financial sector. We realize that some of these jobs are productive. What we're extremely concerned about is the oversupply of some of America's top talent to many of these firms, and firms that helped create the conditions for a Great Recession, which has extremely blighted the lives of millions of Americans.
How do you see that playing out on the Stanford campus? I mean, you're a senior, you're in the job market. You know, do you go down to the counseling center and see the flyers up?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's a very strong emphasis with the Career Development Center here and across elite universities across the country to emphasize finance and management consulting. What we're especially concerned about is the finance side. But I'll just give you an example. I mean, we get emails every single week, you know, announcing different recruitment events. And I'd say about 50 to 75% of all those emails are promoting large, wealthy banks in the United States. What we're concerned about is an oversupply and an overemphasis on institutions that aren't actually necessarily contributing to social and economic productivity in this country.
You say in the beginning of this op-ed in the Stanford Daily, our nation's top universities remain the primary training and recruiting grounds for these same reckless institutions. That, of course, would be the banks. Don't we want smart people working in the banks?
Sure, we do want smart people. What we don't want is 20 to 30% of, say, Harvard's graduates going to work for these banks. America right now faces enormous challenges. We need our top talent focused on solving those problems. Instead of going to many of these banks, which serve to make rich people richer, let's figure out how to create incentives for these undergraduates to go into these other career tracks. I think a great model we've seen recently is that a lot of the top law schools in the country are offering loan forgiveness programs for law school graduates that want to go into public service. We need to have a serious conversation about what is actually a moral and ethical thing for some of the most privileged young members of our society to be doing with their education and their careers.
Taryn Norris. His piece with the title Stop the Wall Street Recruitment was in the Stanford Daily yesterday. Taryn, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
David Frum has been a regular commentator for this program for years, offering the voice of the political right against Robert Reich and the views of the political left. It's been, for the most part, a mutually agreeable relationship. We alienate different segments of our audience every other Wednesday that way. A couple of months ago, though, David came to us and said, listen, I'm not the right guy anymore. What I think doesn't match up with some of the more robust voices in the Republican Party today. So as a way to say goodbye, we thought we'd have him on to explain. Hey, David. Good to talk to you. Welcome.
Hey, thank you.
So why this move? Why is this no longer a good fit for you?
Well, we've been doing a point-counterpoint here between me and Bob Reich for a couple of years, and it's been a lot of fun. I've certainly learned a lot from it. But I think there's a kind of expectation that when you do it, that you represent the broad point of view of your half of the political spectrum. And although I consider myself a conservative and a Republican, and I think that the right-hand side of the spectrum has the better answers for the long-term growth of the economy, low taxes, restrained government, less regulation, it's pretty clear that facing the immediate crisis, very intense crisis, I'm just not representing the view of most people who call themselves Republicans and conservatives these days.
Let me quote you back to yourself in a post that you made on Frum Forum not too long ago. You say, under the pressure of the current crisis, intoxicated by anti-Obama feelings and incited by talk radio and Fox, Republicans have staked out an extreme position on the role of government. That's where we are in this discussion, right?
Yeah, it's not just the role of government, though. We've got a sick patient, the American economy. And we can see that the patient in the next bed, the European economy, he's looking even sicker. And there's a real risk of contagion. And what I think we have to do at a moment like this, have a very, very open creation of money and credit. This is not a moment for government to be cutting back. Here's where Milton Friedman and John Maynard Keynes agreed. They didn't necessarily agree about why to do this medicine, but as to what the medicine was, they did broadly agree, but it's not the medicine that is being prescribed now. The fact is, I'm kind of an outlier, and it's a service to the radio audience if they want to hear people explaining effectively why one of the two great parties takes the view that it does. It needs to have somebody who agrees with that great party. I'm hoping that the party will eventually agree with me, but I can't blink the fact that I don't agree with them on this set of issues.
You seem to be staking a lot on the hope or the expectation that in the long run, the Republican Party will come back to where you are. And I'm reminded, of course, of since you mentioned him, John Maynard Keynes, and his line about in the long run. In the long run, man, we're all dead.
Well, I hope it's not going to be that long.
Right?
And, and unlike Keynes, I don't smoke. So I may have a little bit more of a leeway in front of me. But in politics and public policy, there are better and worse answers. There are things that work and things that don't work. Right now, we are watching state governments try to balance all of their budgets at the same time in the middle of this crisis. We've seen 500,000 public sector jobs disappear. Now, if these were good times, I would applaud that. We need a thinner public sector, especially at the state and local level. But we're seeing what happens when you do that as an anti-recession measure and you make the recession worse. And even though we're in a technical recovery, incomes, employment, all of that remains lagging for people. I think we've rediscovered in this crisis something that I think we all knew, which is that there's a reason why the people of the 1930s built some kind of minimum guarantee, unemployment insurance, health care coverage, and things like that. And it's not just because they wanted to be nice. It's because in a crisis, when people lose their jobs, if there's no social safety net, they lose 100% of their purchasing power.
I should say that for those who need their David Frum fix, he's not disappearing. You are going where, David, to CNN for the political season, right?
I'm going to be one of a bevy of CNN commentators, and I'm continuing to do most of my work writing on my website, where I can say, look, here's what I think, and I don't have to represent myself as a champion for large numbers of people. These are my views. Take them or leave them.
David Frum is, as you've heard me say, the editor of Frum Forum. He used to be a speechwriter for President Bush. And David, I hope we'll have you back every now and then.
Thank you very much.
Next week in this lot, Robert Reich. After that, we'll have some new conservative voices on the broadcast. Write to us with your thoughts about all this. Letters at marketplace.org. Coming up, mosquitoes and the African economy.
Malaria consistently costs the subcontinent of Africa over $40 billion a year.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials rose 102 points today, about 0.9%, ended at 11,518. The NASDAQ climbed 21 points, 0.8%, 2604 the number. The S&P 500 advanced 11 points, nearly 1%, finished up at 1207. Now that the Eurozone Rescue Fund does look eventually set to come through, bank stocks over here turned sunny side up. Citigroup bounced up nearly 5% today. Bank of America collected more than 3%. J.P. Morgan Chase added 2.75% today, that one day ahead of its much-anticipated earnings report that we told you about. PepsiCo bubbled up almost 3%. Third-quarter earnings and revenue exceeded estimates. Always nice to hear. BlackBerry Maker Research in Motion that Mitchell was talking about? Yeah, no, they threw off more than 2% today. The price of the 10-year T-note fell. When that happens, yields rise. The yield on that one rose to 2.21%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Gatebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Commerce Department reports on international trade for August. A House subcommittee on commerce, manufacturing, and trade holds a hearing to examine consumers' attitudes toward privacy. And the Navy observes its birthday. It began on October 13, 1775, when the Continental Congress established the Continental Navy during the War of Independence. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. That's American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
There's no actual list of demands from the people at Occupy Wall Street. Their manifesto that came out last month just has a list of things they're against, one of which is high and rising student debt. We used that the other day as a way to get into a commentary about whether the government should forgive those debts. Justin Wolfers, our commentator, said no. But Dina Gashman from Los Angeles said even a bit of loan forgiveness goes a long, long way.
If companies like Sallie Mae could possibly forgive at least a portion of the interest, especially if people are laid off or unemployed, having trouble looking for a job, to forgive even a portion of the interest would be a huge help to a lot of us out there who can't even afford health insurance, let alone paying off our monthly loan.
James Vineyard from Dallas said that's a bad idea.
If we forgive a bunch of student loan debt, private lenders are going to be much more hesitant about making student loans in the future, fearing it will happen again. This could lead to fewer people being able to get a loan and afford a college education.
We've been discussing Occupy Wall Street quite a bit this week, and judging by our inbox, satisfying absolutely nobody. Richard Johnson wrote from New York City to say that our characterization of the protest was just wrong.
I was there yesterday, and I can tell you the crowd was mainly middle class, normal, non-funky, non-counterculture, not unreformed hippies. They were average people who were simply fed up with the status quo and the egregious imbalances that have developed in our society in the last 30 years, and they're starting to speak up.
Keep on sending us your comments, especially if you don't like what we're doing. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. We found this somewhat mind-boggling statistic on the website of the World Health Organization this morning. A child in Africa, it says, dies from malaria every 45 seconds. 45 seconds. It's a horrible human cost, one that comes with economic consequences for the mostly developing countries where malaria is endemic. The crazy thing is, malaria is easily preventable, and that's where philanthropist Ray Chambers comes in. He made his money in private equity a long time ago. He's now the United Nations Special Envoy for Malaria, with the not unambitious goal of getting rid of that disease forever. It's a story told in a new book by Alex Perry from Time Magazine called Lifeblood: How to Change the World One Dead Mosquito at a Time. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us.
It's our pleasure to be with you.
Alex, let me start with you and ask what might seem like a fundamental question. What drew you to this story?
Living in Africa, working in Africa, I knew how devastating malaria was. I knew its cost. And to get rid of malaria would be an extraordinary boost to development and to getting a fundamental measure to send Africa on a path towards prosperity. So it was its ambition. But there was a bigger story here about the innovations that the campaign was bringing to aid and development work. They were applying essentially business techniques and not a little entrepreneurial hustle to aid.
This is a fairly straightforward problem, Ray Chambers. Mosquito nets and spraying of insecticides, in essence, to reduce mosquitoes in most of the world. I mean, when you sat down to think of your business model as you went about this, what was the equation?
Well, we knew that over 1 million children under the age of 5 had been dying from malaria each year. So you can get 3 children under a bed net that costs less than $10. How do we raise enough money, help to set up the logistics, distribution, make sure the people sleep under the nets, so that could lead us to close to zero deaths?
Alex Perry, you took us to what you call, and I'm going to quote yourself here, the most malarious place on earth.
Mm-hmm. This town, Apach, in northern Uganda, which is essentially a fairly small settlement inside a giant swamp. The average person there was being bitten 4 times a day by a mosquito infected with malaria. So I went, and it was like something out of a daylight horror movie. I drove into this town. It was absolutely deserted. Apart from 3 naked men stumbling around, they were kind of like zombies. And in the year that I was there, which was 2009, 124,000 people had been treated for malaria.
So, Ray Chambers, despite all of that, of the horrors of malaria, or pick your global problem, hunger or poverty or no water, whatever it is, there is an unease about aid, about trying to do good without actually bringing some kind of harm. How do you, and how did you in this instance with malaria, turn aid from benevolence to a business that can succeed? How do you do that?
Well, I think malaria, using the return on investment argument, is very compelling. We do think these bed nets have become so essential to people, and we're constantly pushing the price down. If we can get them down to around $3 or $3.50 a net, we could actually see the average African person paying for the replacement net out of their own pocket sometime in the next 10 to 15 years.
Alex Perry, your thoughts?
The real innovation here is about positioning this not as charity. You don't do this because you're a nice person. You do it because it's in your self-interest. So, for instance, you go to ExxonMobil and you say, do you know what, if you covered your workforce for malaria, you don't say that would be a nice thing. You say your workforce will be a lot more productive. Your profits will go up. Your absenteeism will go down. That's where the sustainability comes in. That's when people start doing it without having to be asked.
Alex, just to bring it full circle here, you went back to that zombie town after the campaign had been in full swing for a while. Tell me what that was like.
So, yeah, I went back 18 months later, and the streets are packed. The buildings have been repainted. Children are going to school, and the malaria rates had more than halved. I mean, it was just extraordinary.
Alex Perry's book about Ray Chambers and the fight against malaria is called Lifeblood: How to Change the World One Dead Mosquito at a Time. Gentlemen, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, AIG, the insurance company we all came to know and love during the financial crisis, has a new product it's offering. It's going to start issuing, wait for it, reputation insurance. I don't think there's anything else to say after that, so I'm not gonna. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 102 points, about 9-tenths of 1%. The NASDAQ up 21 points, 8-tenths percent. The S&P 500 advanced 11 points, nearly 1% on that particular index. Robbie Carman, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time, back on the big show, more seniors are raising their grandchildren these days, and they're going to need a place to do it.
The communities of the future are not what the communities of the past look like. I think there's a growing need for housing for multi-generational households.
I'm Kyle Rizdal. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM. That's American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.